Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome to the Inside China Basin Baseball Podcast on thesportsvirus.com, featuring players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. We also welcome in our new sponsor, Enviro Heating and Air, servicing all brands of HVAC systems in Petaluma, Santa Rosa, Sonoma County, and Marin County. Today we have two very special guests. First, we have Vogie, Ryan Vogelsong, who is now a roving pitching instructor in the Giants organization and recently had a lot of success with Chris Stratton after he was sent down to AAA. Stratton came up and has had three good outings in a row, and he's pitching on Saturday for the Giants in Milwaukee. And speaking of Milwaukee, we're going to talk to Brewers television play-by-play announcer Brian Anderson, who also does play-by-play for Turner Sports. But first, I want to tell you about my favorite golf course, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. Live in San Francisco and love to play golf? Visit TPC Harding Park and purchase your two-year resident card, giving you immediate savings on golf and other programs at the park. Cut your green fees in half by purchasing your card today. Visit www.tpc.com/Harding Park for more information. Well, Ryan, first of all, how's it going working with the Giants pitchers this summer? Of course, a lot has been made of the work that you did with Chris Stratton. He really turned it around, had some really good starts lately. I would imagine that was pretty satisfying to see that happen.
You know, it's been a good experience. Obviously, way different than, you know, the norm. But, you know, as a player, you talk pitching all the time with the other guys, especially the guys in the rotation. You know, when you're sitting there during a game, you're always kind of talking pitch sequencing and you talk about mechanics. So the transition has been a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. But, you know, it's tough and it's rewarding. You know, you have the tough stuff where you go in and work with a guy and he doesn't execute it the next time out, which is part of baseball and part of getting better is you don't always get results from hard work. And then you have a guy like Chris where, you know, I said about two things to him in Nashville in the bullpen, and he was able to do it right away and had instant success. So, it's been interesting. It's been fun. It's been interesting, and it's been an educational year for me.
What were the two things? I mean, I know that he had trouble with his command, but and he sort of ironed that out after you talked to him.
Well, Chris, to Chris's credit, you know, I keep reading and hearing stuff, but it's really all Chris. You know, I gave him a couple little things, but he was the one that executed it, and he's the one that went out and made pitches. So, I really didn't have much to do with it other than just a couple little things I told him. And for me, Chris is very easy to work with because he does a lot of things mechanically that I used to do. So fixes that work for me are probably going to work for him. And one was just, I felt like he was just getting a little rotational and coming off the ball a little bit. And that does two things. It'll make the ball flatten out. It'll make it cut. And the biggest thing for me when you do that is the hitter sees the ball early. So I just talked to him about keys that I used to have to try and stay. I hate using the word closed. I like the word online. Mm-hmm. And so I just talked to him about two little keys that helped me stay online and hide the ball. And man, the bullpen he threw in Nashville was, I don't think he missed more than two pitches in a row the whole time. And it was pretty phenomenal. And I just told him, I said, hey, that's it right there. And if you can just get your mind to link up with what's going on so you can make adjustments and feel this when it's happening, you're going to be all good. And he, to his credit, he's done a very good job with it.
Yeah, eventually he throws eight scoreless against the Diamondbacks, and he's scheduled to be on the mound in Milwaukee this weekend. We'll see how he does. Now, I would imagine that working with a guy who has similar mechanics kind of fits right in for you. Is it more challenging and difficult when you run into a guy who has funky mechanics? I mean, I can imagine it would be hard for anybody to try to correct Tim Lincecum, for example, when he was with the Giants, because, you know, his delivery was formed by his dad, and I don't know that anybody could even figure out how to try to get him back to what he needed to do.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of where I learned I learned that sometimes it doesn't just pop out to you, right? Most of the time, if you're watching a guy and you understand mechanics and you understand pitching, something pretty glaring will stick out to you. But the first time watching Timmy and trying to talk to Timmy about mechanics and pitching, that's when I learned, hey, sometimes it's not as easy as it looks. And it took me a little while to kind of be able to break Timmy's mechanics down and see where he was in different spots. And, you know, eventually about halfway through a year together with him, I was able to kind of tell him a little bit about what I saw and what I thought. And, it's definitely happened to me at this time this year. You know, it's kind of a hard thing to swallow your pride a little bit in this game, but I figured out that sometimes you have to do that. You know, there's a couple instances this year where I'd be somewhere watching a kid and you know, he wasn't throwing the great or throwing the ball terrible, but there was obviously something going on, and he would come over and say, "What do you got?" And I'm like, "Buddy, I haven't seen enough yet." Like, it doesn't always pop up right away. You know, some people it does, some people it doesn't. So eventually the more that I would get to see him throw and kind of talk to him about what his thought process and stuff was too, that'll help, key some things. But sometimes it's not easy. And like you said, when the delivery is a little bit different, it makes it even harder.
Well, the Giants have some really good prospects in the minor leagues, whether it be John Gavin, who was pitching well at Augusta and got called up to San Jose, or Logan Webb, who pitched well in San Jose, got called up to Double-A, or even Sean Anderson, who went from Double-A to Triple-A, and, you know, he may have a chance at the Giants roster next year. Did you work with any of those guys? Who were some of the guys that you really enjoyed working with?
You know, I actually talked to all those guys, and I hit every minor league spot this year for at least, you know, 3 or 4 days. In the case of Richmond, I was there 3 times this year, Augusta twice, and I only saw San Jose and Sacramento once. And, you know, I did about a week up in Salem. So I did see everybody at least one time and did have conversations with those three particular guys that you mentioned. The good thing is they're all very intelligent. They all work very hard. They're all determined to get to the big leagues. They are all competitive, which I love, which, you know, was my nature. And, you know, as far as Sean, you know, I think the biggest thing for him next is just learning how to sequence pitches, because he's going to compete. His stuff is above average, and he just needs to learn how to put it together, which is kind of the last thing that comes for a pitcher for me is, you know, reading the swing of a hitter and being able to sequence pitches together. So Sean's very close. Logan Webb is going to be another good one. You know, plus fastball, plus breaking ball. His changeup improved a ton this summer. And, he's another guy that loves to compete. And I think you'll see him in the rotation at some point. You know, hopefully sooner than later, but I think he has a chance to be there. And, you know, Gavin's a big boy, competes, knows how to pitch, and he just needs to learn how to put it all together with the other things that I was talking about as far as reading swings and sequencing pitches. But we definitely have some guys that can throw the ball. We're not short on arms, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm imagining that another part of your position with the Giants as a roving instructor is not just the mechanics, but just the mental part. I mean, because to me, just from being around baseball and being around AAA for a long time, I think one of the hardest things is when you get sent down, or, you know, in your case, if you get released and you're really trying to keep it together mentally to stay in the game and to get back up to the major leagues. You know, how many of those conversations that did you have, and do you think you'll be having?
You know, I think I've had as many of those conversations as I did mechanics and pitch sequences. And, you know, I think that's where – I think that's what separates me from everybody else. Not only can I talk to you about pitching, mechanics, sequencing, the things we talked about, reading swings, you know, everybody in this organization knows my story to some extent. So to be able to sit down there with a kid that's kind of struggling and explain to him, you know, what might help him get through that faster and help him understand that this might not be the last time it happens. You know, my experiences in the game, I've had more conversations, or I shouldn't say more, just as many conversations about that as I have pitching. And, you know, some really good conversations with people, not just pitchers. I've had, you know, five or six position players call me aside and ask me questions about it because they're struggling. So I think if there's been a really, really positive thing and something that I can impact these players with is that. And just being able to talk to them and help them get through struggles faster than it took me. If I can do that, then we're ahead of the ball game.
It's almost as if there should be a Ryan Vogelsong handbook for a lot of players that get to the Major League seriously, because I mean the perseverance that you had, you know, your story is really amazing, because you start out in the Major Leagues, you're not having the success that you would like, and then you end up going over to Japan, you come back, and 2010, especially, I look at that year, that's the year the Giants won their first World Series, and you have two times where you're released that year, you go to Venezuela, and it really turned you around. I mean, why did that happen in Venezuela? What were the things that happened to you that did turn it around so that you could get back in 2011 to the big leagues with the Giants, and the rest is history?
Well, you know, it kind of started at the end of 2010 when I signed with the Angels and went to Salt Lake City. And just like everybody else in life and their career, you know, sometimes it just takes one different person to see something and tell you that. Just like myself with Chris Stratton the other day. I'm sure he's heard that, you know, somebody tell him that probably 50 times in his career already.
Mm-hmm.
But it came out of somebody different's mouth on a certain day at a certain time, and it clicked, right?
Right.
And that was kind of my way. That was kind of happened to me in 2010 in Salt Lake. I had a pitching coach named Eric Bennett there. And, you know, I had been released by the Phillies, went home, and then went there, and I threw a bullpen with him. And one of the first things he said to me was, "Hey, man, your shoulders are all over the map right now." And he's like, "You got to keep your shoulders still." And I kept my shoulder still, and, man, it changed everything for me. And that bullpen for me was kind of like Stratton's bullpen with me watching him in Nashville. And it wasn't as good as Stratton's was right away, but it was much better, and the pitches got more consistent, and the outings were more consistent. And I said to myself, I think I got something here. And I wasn't sure, because I had told myself that many times before, I think I have something here. And then the next month I was picking up the pieces again. So guardedly, I'm like, I think I have something here. And I needed to go to winter ball probably to get a job for the next season, because I had pitched so bad in Triple A twice. But the stuff that he told me that day, I focused on when I got the winter ball, and it locked me in, and I threw the ball great in winter ball. And it gave me a chance to come back to the Giants, and the rest is pretty much history.
Yeah, I remember seeing you in that 2011, I think it was the opener for the Fresno Grizzlies, and thinking, wow, this guy, he looks great. And then you get called up right after that, and things start working out really well. I mean, in your wildest dreams, you know, you're thinking, okay, your dream is let's get back to the big leagues and have some success. But to do what you did, I mean, to end up winning two World Series and the Giants winning every one of your postseason starts, now that you get a chance to reflect on it and people ask you about it, can you believe that all of that happened after you did make that change?
I honestly can't. You know, there's probably not a day that I wake up now and kind of look at myself in the mirror and, you know, I'll see a picture on the wall and I kind of don't believe that's me, you know, in those pictures. It's like that. I know it happened, but it doesn't seem possible that it happened. Especially when I start thinking about way before that. And, you know, a lot of things get refreshed this summer when I'm telling kids stories and they're asking questions about Japan. And, you know, everybody thinks Japan is great because the money's great. And I'm like, wait a second here. Listen to this story. It wasn't easy. Like, I didn't just go to Japan and make some good money and then come back. You know, this is what I went through in Japan as well. Like, it wasn't just go over there and have some cake and eat it too and then come back and be good. So it really doesn't, when I look at those pictures and see videos and stuff, it really doesn't seem like that was me. It's like I'm watching a story about somebody else. But I tell you what, I know that deep down inside that if I would have done it without all the adversity, but I know with everything that I went through, come back and do what I did, and not just me, what we did as a team, made it so much better.
Well, it was great when you went on the Wall of Fame with Brian Wilson and Matt Cain, you know, your teammates. I mean, that had to be emotional for you. And, you know, and it's real. I mean, you talk about how you can't believe it's you, but that's there forever. And, I mean, that really had to be just something else in late July when the Giants honored you that way.
You know, it's I'm so happy you asked me about that, because right now in my mind, it's one of the best days of my life and one of the worst, because I feel like I made the worst speech ever. I had all these, you know, all these great thoughts in my mind, and I'm not a big write down stuff for a speech, but I do think about it a lot and go through stuff in my head. And I had all these great things I wanted to say about being a Giant in 2000 and 2001 and these great teammates I had, and then coming back in a different era and being with another set of great teammates. And I got up there, and there was so much emotion and so much going on that I lost everything. and I listen, take pride on giving speeches. I mean, you probably saw some of my speeches, you know, on the field after Giants games, and my sure. Willie Mack speech. And I take pride in public speaking and saying stuff that people remember for a long time. And I walked away that day going, what a great day. And I'm probably only going to remember this for butchering my speech. So to pick up that a little bit, one thing that I did want to say was that day that I just totally dropped the ball on was, never in my life would I ever think that I would be honored with something, not only with Giants players that were great, but they're the greatest players of all time in baseball.
Yeah.
Willie Mays and Cepeda and McCovey and Marshall. I mean, Gaylord Perry, these guys are enshrined in Cooperstown. And my plaque is, you know, 20 steps away from theirs. So, I mean, never in my wildest dreams did, you know, I ever thought I would be in an All-Star game, 2-time World Series champ, and then have my plaque on the wall next to some of the all-time greats, not only with the Giants, but in the all-time greats of baseball.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Yeah, and you said it was your Cooperstown, which is really, you know, what that sounds like when you say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, every one of those players, and it really every player has his own style and what they're known for. And you were known for the game face. And when I think about the game face, I always wonder, like, how approachable you were maybe with teammates, because, you know, we saw you on the mound. We saw you were like what you were like maybe when you were taking the mound or when you left the game publicly. But I don't know what it was like in that clubhouse. I mean, can you tell us, you know, what your teammates' reaction was to you on a game day?
You know, one of the things that I did love about my teammates was they respected and understood why I had to be that way. Nobody gave me grief about it in a disrespectful way. Did they give me a hard time about it the next day or like 2 days prior? Absolutely. But it was always joking around, you know. It was never malicious. And one of the things that, like I said, that I loved about that team was the other 24 guys in that room understood that that's what I had to do to operate, and that's what I had to do to be successful. And they all understood that. And I don't know if they all understood it in the same way, but they all respected me enough as a teammate and as a player to just let me be the way I needed to be. And it's not always like that. And I know that from experience, because that just didn't happen when I was in San Francisco. That's the way I treated every game, or tried to treat every game in the past. And I had guys that just couldn't understand why, and all they wanted to do was try and be a distraction. So the fact that those guys in that room understood that's the way I had to be made life so much easier. And I mean, the stories are real, you know. If I was pitching that day, probably didn't talk to you. I might have gave you a glare out of the side of my eye if I thought you were doing something that I didn't think was appropriate. I probably grunted at a few people when they said hi. you know, sometimes just a head nod. It was real. I mean, it's not a made up story or a myth. I was pretty intense, and that's the way I had to be. And, you know, and people are like, why? And because that's how I stayed focused. And that's how myself from getting nervous, and that's how I kept anxiety out, was the more I concentrated, the less outside stuff was in. And I knew my game, right? I knew that I didn't have 97 mile an hour under the hood and this unbelievable curveball and cutter and changeup. But I knew deep down in my heart that if I could outfocus the other team for 2.5 hours, and if they weren't committed to concentrating as much as I was going to focus, that we were going to win. And that was my confidence, and that was my strength, and that's just who I had to be.
Well, with all that being said, I can only imagine how it really went and how difficult it was when you were taking the mound for the Pittsburgh Pirates and your return to AT&T Park. Difficult in some ways, and of course, had to be appreciative of the standing ovation you got. I mean, that was something else, really, when you took the mound and the Giants fans gave you that ovation before you even threw the first pitch. And your Pirates teammates, I know Francisco Cervelli, stepped out in front of home plate and said, hey, just take this in before you throw the first pitch of the game.
Yeah, it was that was a pretty amazing moment and something that I absolutely did not expect. I knew how much the San Francisco Giant fans loved me and appreciated me, and I think they understand how much I appreciate them and how much I needed them to be who I wanted to be. But I never expected that, and it was hard because, you know, just everything I just told you about how what went into a game for me, it took everything I had not to take my hat off at that point and tip my cap. But I knew at the end of the day that I had to try and win a baseball game, and I could not let my guard down for 1 second. So the best part about that day was that I got a chance to do it when I walked off the field. That kind of made up for not doing it before the game. And my Pirates teammates were great that day, too. They all, without me knowing, said, hey, when he goes out to warm up, we're all going to stay in here and just let him have his moment, and which I didn't know until after the game either. And actually, I noticed when I got out there, I turned around and nobody was standing there, and I was thinking, what the heck's going on here, you know? And they were like, yeah, we just wanted you to have a moment. And I said, well, I appreciate that, but don't ever do it again. But it was, yeah, that was an amazing night. And, you know, I've got so many memories from being a Giant, and all the great ones are from being a San Francisco Giant. And there's a lot of very special ones from AT&T Park that I will never forget.
Well, that brought new meaning to the word shift. Yeah, everybody shifted into the dugout. Before I let you go, Ryan, just wanted to ask you about your future because you're doing a great job with these pitchers. It sounds like you'd be a great pitching coach. Is that something you're interested in?
You know, I am. When that time's going to come, I'm not sure. I wasn't sure, like I said, I wasn't sure how much I was going to know going into this summer and how much help I could be. But the more and more I did it, the more I understand that I have a responsibility to this game to pass down my knowledge and to pay it forward from not only stuff that I learned from other people, but what I learned myself. And I do feel like I have a pretty good knack of seeing guys' mechanics and seeing sequences and communicating with a player, because I did go through so much. That's one thing I tell these kids the first time I meet them. There's not anything you're going to go through in this game that I didn't go through. I tell them, I said, I had Tommy John. I got released. I got traded. I got hit in the face. I got released again. I said, I went to Japan. I said, there is nothing that you're going to do in this game that I didn't go through. So, and I think that helps me relate to them. So back to the original question, yes. I do see myself as a pitching coach at some point. Like I said, I just don't know when that is because my son is 9 and he's really starting to love the game of baseball. And he's actually, and I know every dad says this, that he's pretty good. But he's got some good genes, and I kind of want to be around for him and see how he does. And then we'll kind of go from there. But my ultimate goal at this point, I think, yes, is at some point be a big league pitching coach.
I think you'll be a great one. Ryan, thanks so much for the time. You were always a class act from my perspective, going into that Giants clubhouse, you know, looking for guests on this podcast. You were always very willing and able, and I appreciate you coming on here. Look forward to catching up with you again next summer as you progress with the Giants pitchers.
All right. Thanks, bud. Thanks for having me.
That's former Giants pitcher Ryan Vogelsong On Wednesday, I had a chance to catch up with Brian Anderson. He's the television play-by-play voice of the Milwaukee Brewers to set us up for the Giants Brewers series this weekend in Milwaukee. Brian also does play-by-play for Turner Sports. Here was that conversation. Well, Brian, the Brewers are having a great season. This has been really exciting for you guys to be right there with the Cubs, on the verge of a sweep of the series as we sit here on Wednesday and do this podcast, and in pretty good position as far as the wild card is concerned. What has been the reaction there in Milwaukee to the way this team has played and the moves they made to get them to this point?
Well, they made it through a difficult stretch right before the All-Star break, and then coming out of the All-Star break, that was really one of the challenging pieces of the schedule that I think they felt like if they could, just stay relevant during that time. They had 17 straight games without a day off coming out of the All-Star break. They played 21 games in 20 days going into the All-Star break, so kind of a brutal schedule. But they knew if they could keep their head above water, then the schedule was going to turn in their favor. And I think what we're seeing now, the Brewers have won 5 consecutive series now, that they are enjoying that part of it, because there have been regular days off. If you notice on the standings, the Brewers have played 3 or 4 more games than most of the other teams that are involved in the wild card race and the division race. So, I think they knew this was coming, and then you have September call-ups, which gives you more opportunities to rest guys, mainly bullpen. That's where it shows up the most, I think, is in your bullpen. So all that being said, they've added some pieces. They don't feel like they're out of it in the division, even though they're 5 back in the loss column to the Cubs. They played a lot more games, which means, the Cubs are in the middle of a stretch of 23 games in 23 days, so that's tough on a bullpen, tough on bodies as you're going through a schedule. So, and the Brewers still have the Cubs 4 more times, so they feel like they're right there in the picture. They've added some nice pieces that they think is going to help, and I think they feel like they're poised to strike right now with the schedule that turns in their favor and matchups against their own division the rest of the way.
I think it's rare that you add players and it just seems like the right moves are made left and right. I mean, it seems like everything is worked out. I mean, Yelich is having an MVP-type season. Kane has been really incredible, hitting over .300, the second best on-base percentage in the National League. So, I mean, do the Brewers feel like, it just kind of all worked out with the acquisitions that they made?
Yeah, they haven't hit the home run. They haven't had the Cole Hamels-type success, but the offseason acquisitions have been that, Kane and Yelich specifically. Matt Albers has not been what they had hoped. He's struggling. That was a piece on the bullpen that they were counting on. So they've made some moves. They've had a flurry of, I wouldn't say blockbuster moves. Certainly Kane and Yelich would be blockbuster moves in the offseason, but as far as in-season trade deadline deals, no, they haven't had those, but they went out and got Mike Moustakas. They've made a deal for some relievers. They picked up Joaquin Soria from the Chicago White Sox. They got Xavier Cedeno, who's, not a player I think most baseball fans would recognize or feel like that's an important move, but for the Brewers it is, because he's a lefty that's had a lot of success in situational roles this year. So that was an important deal for them to make as well. And then, they've added pieces like Curtis Granderson, kind of a late, waiver wire deal that they were able to pull off with the Toronto Blue Jays. And Jonathan Scope came prior to the trade deadline as well. So these are all pieces just to add on. I think the Brewers felt like, their bullpen was a strength, but probably taxed and maybe a little overworked with that stretch of games I just mentioned. So they've added to that. They've been able to pick up some arms. And, I think they feel like their core group is good enough to contend. And now they've added some supplement pieces that they hope are going to bring them over the top. I mean, I think, more importantly than what they got on the field, and they got a lot on the field, no question, but they feel like they've improved the room. I know a lot of the analytics group doesn't appreciate or feel like
chemistry matters, but I do think it matters. I think the kind of pros you have in your clubhouse to organize the ball club to, you know, to get through the tougher times, I think it matters. I think guys like Lorenzo Cain and Mike Moustakas and Curtis Granderson and Christian Yelich are really important pieces for that. Eric Kratz, nobody really talked about Kratz, but he's been great at 38 years old behind the plate. So these are all like small taps on the rock that they're hoping to finally shatter that rock. They haven't been to the postseason in 2011, but they do like their team and they like their pitching staff. They like their starting rotation. They didn't go get a big starting pitcher that everybody assumed they would. They did just add Gio Gonzalez just a few days ago in the waiver wire trade period. But they like their rotation. They think it's a rotation made up of a lot of no-names that are pitching pretty well and getting them where they want to be in games. And so, you know, they're going to go with that statement until they find out what this group can do. And I think that resonates well with the team, too. Like, the front office is basically saying, look, we like you guys. We think you're all talented enough to go where we think you can go, and that's into the postseason and contend for a World Series. So I think the players like hearing that as well.
Well, I agree with you about the chemistry factor. I mean, I think it's a major factor when you're talking about trying to win a World Series, and a guy like Moustakas, who's already won one with the Kansas City Royals, and Cain as well. And the guy who has to try to make sure all that works is Craig Counsell. And it seems like he's doing such a great job. And, you know, Brian, I go back a long way with Counsell. He was on a team that I covered in the Northwest League when he was a player, when he first got drafted by the Rockies. And you could tell then, as just a kid, that he was such a cerebral type player, that he was going to be, you know, a good player, but also that he could be a manager someday. You could tell that right away when he was, you know, 22, 23 years old. So what has the experience been like for you being around Counsell, and how has he been able to get this team to mesh together?
Well, it starts with the fact that he is Wisconsin's favorite son on a baseball side. You know, he's from here. He grew up in Whitefish Bay, which is a suburb outside Milwaukee. He has maintained a home here all these years. He played for the Brewers in two different stints. He was on their last playoff team in 2011. So it starts with the equity that he brings as a manager in this market. So he can probably get away with more than any other manager in the major leagues because people love him, and rightly so. He's one of their own. So it starts there, and that, you know, then he's a baseball guy. I mean, I think the relationship that he has forged with the general manager, and remember, Counsell was involved in the general manager search. He wasn't the lead voice, that would have been the owner, but he was involved. And so it's unusual that a general manager is hired with a manager already in place. And with the understanding, David Stearns was hired with the understanding that Craig Counsell is the manager. So it wasn't a scenario where you bring in a general manager and then let him pick his manager and staff. That was never the case. And so I think from the beginning, the owner, Mark Adonasio, set the standard that this is who I want to manage the team. Whoever I select to be the general manager of the team, we are all going to be in lockstep with player personnel. And I think they've done a great job. I mean, I would say David Stearns got the job primarily because of his relationship with Counsell and the way they hit it off and the way they've been able to communicate. And so, you know, right or wrong, good or bad, you need those three pieces all connected: owner, general manager, manager, and then of course it spreads down to coaching staff, players and whatnot, but they're all very well connected. So when there are decisions to be made, personnel decisions to be made, disciplinary decisions to be made, they're all in accord. And I think that's how you succeed now. You know, watching the San Antonio Spurs all those years like I did, that was a pretty tight group, and you never were able to break through that group. And players knew that these guys are together, either I'm on or I'm off. And I think they've added personnel that has brought some character and brought some professionalism to the clubhouse. And I think it all pays off, and I think Counsell's a huge part of it. You know, he's not just an ancillary figure here who is taking what is given to him and trying to win games. It's hardly that. It's complete involvement on every level on what kind of personnel is going to make up the team. What kind of player are you looking for? What are the needs? And I think both
listen to each other well, GM and manager. And then, you know, Council understands that responsibility and that role, and he worked in the front office before he became a manager, so he understands how difficult that can be too, and the dynamics of who delivers such messages, how does the analytics filter from the analytics department to the coaching staff to the players. He's cognizant on all of that and understands not to overwhelm, understands when guys, the personalities of guys that need to be pushed, guys that need to be loved, all of that. So I think he's kind of the full package as far as the new age manager goes, who's completely involved in everything up and down the organization.
Well, he faced an unusual situation that could have fractured the clubhouse. The Josh Hader tweets from years ago, which surfaced at the All-Star game. So after that, how did he handle that? Because obviously it didn't fracture the team. I know when they came out here to San Francisco, you heard the boos for Hader, and I guess that just kind of got washed away after a while. But it, you know, really could have been a very difficult situation that it seems like he handled very well.
Well, that's one of his bigger tests as a manager. You know, I mean, that was certainly one of his big moments. That would be the Ryan Braun moment for Ron Rennecke when Ron Rennecke was managing in Milwaukee. So that's certainly something that they had to deal with. I will say that even before it got back to Craig Council in Milwaukee before the season resumed, I think the guys that were at the All-Star game, specifically the African-American players, Jeremy Jefferson, Lorenzo Cain, came to the defense in the current character of Josh Hader. I want to be careful how I say that. None of those players condone what he said, condone the actions that he made when he was, you know, in high school, and understanding it's a very serious issue, but they all know him well now, and they stood up for him and said, look, I don't know what you were. I know what you are now. Here's the plan for you to make this better for the team. And that was, you know, I would say these guys got out in front with it, and you know, that then became the public apology. Then quick to accept any kind of disciplinary action that Major League Baseball would offer. There was no pushback whatsoever from Josh Hader. You know, he knew. I mean, there's a lot of players that would say that was another thing from a long time ago. I don't want to hear anything about it. This, you know, and take a different approach. He didn't. He was very upset about it, and he seemed like a person that was affected by it, and then even made the point that he's learned so much since those days being in professional baseball and understanding different cultures. So for what it's worth, you know, you believe him or not, that's up to you as a fan or an audience, but I think in the room, I think they felt like he's being genuine here, and that's where it started. And then Council, same thing, put him out front. Like, this is your mess, and you need to clean it up. We're a baseball team, and we're your family, and we'll stick by you on the baseball side, but it's your mess to clean up, and that's pretty much what he did. And then that was it. And it's still his mess to have to deal with, but as far as how it affects the team and how it affects his day-to-day interactions with the team, you know, I think that was nipped in the bud quickly. And had Josh Hader taken a different approach, then he probably would have been a guy that would have been excommunicated on some level, you know? Yeah. I don't know if it would have been a trade or if it would have been something along those lines, but I do think that would have been part of the picture, is like, okay, we will now move on from Josh Hader had he not reacted the way he did in an authentic measure.
Was that reaction part of why the fans reacted the way they did? Because I got to be honest with you, Brian, from the outside looking in, it was just surprising to hear that he got this ovation when he came out there for the Brewers for the first time. Now, not that I expected him to get booed big time, but at the same time, I just wondered if there would be, you know, some reticence to you know, just give him this support. And instead of being apprehensive about it, the fans just said, okay, we're going to get behind this guy.
You know, I think the standing ovation was, I don't want to say taken out of context, because it was a moment that happened. I was there. I called that game. We saw, I mean, it was our cameras and our commentary that was on that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't I don't, you know what? And I don't want to be insensitive by saying this, because I think there would be a lot of people that would take the wrong approach and cheer the fact that he was picked on, now he's our guy, now he's back. I do think there are people like that that exist, but I don't think that's the majority. I think Milwaukee is a place where they love their players. They treat them like family. They think of them like family. No different than Giants fans with Barry Bonds all those years. They were the first to cheer Barry Bonds when he went through all of his PED stuff. I mean, they were the ones that he has a home. And so I think the home crowd is always like that. Okay, now you take a habit that when Josh Hader comes into a game, the game's usually on the line. It's an important moment. The PA announcer announces, now pitching for the Brewers, Josh Hader. And people just respond to that, right. So I felt like that was, to me, was a little bit of a shot that was a bit of a stretch. And that's my opinion. I know others have a different opinion. The Dodgers were in town. The Dodger writers were seeing this in its own context of, here's a guy who did wrong, now he comes back, he gets a standing ovation. That was creepy. That was not the right thing to do. For me, I just felt like this is a fan base that loves their players, and they're saying, he's back on the mound. We really need him to be good right now. And they announced his name in a way that you would cheer, and they cheered. I can see both sides of the argument, but having watched players go through various things here in this market, from Giovanni Gallardo's DUI charge to Ryan Braun's PED case, among many other things, Carlos Gomez having a few public snaps, I think Brewers fans always welcome back their players. I mean, it's a very highly publicized drug issue with the teams in the 80s with some of their best players. And I think the Brewers fans still love these guys, right or wrong. It's just the way this market is. And so to take a shot on Brewers fans in that scenario, I thought was a little bit of a pile on in that case. No, that's in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a really good explanation. And I did want to finish up by just sort of asking you about being the guy who has the unique perspective of being a television play-by-play announcer for a team, and then going out on the national stage with Turner Sports. And I know you really enjoy that, but it is a shift when you go out and do those games, and you've got two different teams, or maybe even you are doing a Brewers game on the national stage, and I know you've done that before in the postseason. How you react to those situations and become sort of, a little bit of a different announcer, really, in those situations?
Well, it changes for sure. I've done the Brewers twice in the playoffs. Did them in 2008, did them again in 2011 in the NLCS. And I think there's a little... To be honest with you, the blowback comes more from the Brewer fans, who are used to hearing me constantly speak in a Brewers tone.
Right.
So if a guy gives up a two-run home run, you call the home run by Anthony Rizzo, but you say, boy, the Brewers give up a two-run home run. You know what I mean? When you're doing a playoff series, you celebrate success. So whatever the success is of the team that's having that success. So I remember getting more blowback from Brewers fans, raising my voice on an Albert Pujols home run against the Brewers in 2011 than anything the Brewers did, right? So that's just part of it. I mean, I think Vin Scully certainly dealt with that all those years. Joe Buck, anybody who's ever, John Miller, who called Giants games and before that Orioles games. That's just part of it. We all have to come from somewhere, and everybody who's emerged at a network level has worked somewhere else, worked for a market. I've just been in Milwaukee for 12 years, but there's a switch you turn, and you call it, it's almost like an official, I would say. I don't care about wins and losses. I may care after the game, but in the middle of the game, you're so focused on the next pitch, the next play, getting to the next commercial, so it's literally commercial to commercial. Okay, what are we going to do in this segment of the broadcast? We're going to have a package on this pitcher. We're going to show all the home runs. We've got graphics here. You're so not in the macro that you're in the micro. You're just, you're into every element that comes next, right? It'd be like if I was playing golf, and yes, of course, I want to win the match, but you've got to play each shot, and you kind of deal with it all afterwards. And I want the Brewers to have success. I mean, I don't make any bones about that. I'm a fan of their team. I'm a fan of this market. I've lived here. I've chosen to make my home here. But doing a game is completely different than being a fan. Completely different. It never even crosses my mind that I'm going to sway a broadcast one way or the other to cover for a team that I work for. It just doesn't happen. I mean, not with me. I'd never experienced that ever, that sensation ever, that I felt like I need to cover for someone because I know these guys. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't. Fans want to make it happen, but it just doesn't.
Right. The very last thing here, just from your perspective, looking at the Giants and sort of their strategy going into this year, you know, picking up Andrew McCutchen, who has since been traded, and Evan Longoria, and sort of, you know, the veteran guys, the Giants have sort of been banking on their core players, and it didn't work out. I mean, they've sort of been around the 500 mark all year, and then they're not going to be in the postseason. What do you think about the strategy that they've had, and just from your perspective, what they need to do? What do the Giants need to do to sort of get back to where they were?
Well, I can't answer that. That's a very tricky question because I don't, you know, everybody, they know more about their organization and what they have and what kind of assets they have. There's no formula. I mean, you've got to get some breaks, you know, and winning three World Series titles in that 5-year span, you get breaks and you make calls on players that work out really well.
Yeah.
And that happens. And so you can't win all those bets. So from the outside looking in, it's like, well, that's probably a market correction or law of averages because they did hit on so many players. I mean, to win three World Series in 5 years, I mean, in the modern era, that's pretty much unprecedented in
sure.
this day and age of baseball. So, you know, I think it's an organization that has great star power and players that they count on heavily and that their fan base loves. And, you know, then you got to make some tough calls on some players in those roles. You know, do you have better prospects coming up or prospects that have a higher ceiling than the players that you're paying all this money to in the major leagues? But the Giants are, you know, one of the gold standard organizations in baseball. And, you know, it's been a few down years here, but I think it's got to be 5 or 6 down years for people to around the game, including me, to look at the Giants in any other way than this is a first-class organization that has not made great decisions on players here recently, but made so many great decisions that they're still way ahead of the game in that regard. I mean, I don't question anything the Giants do. Do they need a managerial change? Do they need a coaching change on some level? Do they need new personnel, better prospects? I'm sure, you know, all that passes through their offices on what they should do to try to be a better team right now in the current day. But, you know, I mean, the Giants still have their place in the game of baseball, and it's up there among the elites. Sometimes you get too deep in it in the Giants market, but, you know, from the outside, they have their place among the elites. It's one of the great ballparks. It's, you know, they're packing the place every game. It's one of the great environments to go watch a game played. So, yeah, there's no feeling sorry for the Giants, who have had just some bad turns here and some bad decisions, but nobody doubts that they'll be back in a big way, winning and contending for pennants.
Well, I agree with you. Brian, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate your generosity to take the time to talk to us here on this podcast. And good luck the rest of the season with the Brewers and beyond in the postseason with Turner Sports.
Okay, Joe. Thanks, man. Always great to visit with you.
That's Brewers television play-by-play announcer Brian Anderson. We'll also see him on the playoffs with Turner Sports doing play-by-play. I want to thank him and Ryan Vogelsong for joining us on Inside China Basin. Join us again on Tuesday. We'll be out at AT&T Park in San Francisco as the Giants take on the Atlanta Braves. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening to Inside China Basin on thesportsvirus.com.